Trouble. You'll never make it to the newscast.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Tuesday, March 10th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. And we have a number of public hearings. We are convening right now as a subcommittee. I think our other two members will be with us shortly. So I will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 331. And Erin, could you please tell us about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 331 directs Department of Corrections to determine last known address of inmates in custody of the department and submit information to the Secretary of State, directs Secretary of State to adjust population data reported to in federal census to reflect resident status of inmates before incarceration, requires Legislative Assembly or Secretary of State, whichever is applicable, to reapportion state into legislative districts based on adjusted population data, requires use of adjusted population data to apportion county or municipal boundaries. We have no revenue impact, and there has not been a fiscal impact issued yet, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And I see we've been joined by Senator Shields and Representative Bentz. So please welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate. I am a sponsor of Senate Bill 331, along with Representative Parrish, Representative Frederick, Senator Beyer, and Senator Edwards. And I'm also pleased that Representative Bentz of Ontario has decided to join us today as well. This is a topic that we've been working on for about 6 years, and I think now, particularly since we're a little bit distanced between redistricting, this might be the exact opportune time to take this on. And it's not going to have a huge effect on any given day. I think Oregon might have 14 or 15,000 inmates scattered across the state, and about 500 or 600 of those are in my district. Senate Bill 331 is really just about fair proportionment. The Oregon State Constitution, Article 4, Section 4, states that, quote, for the purpose of voting, no person shall be deemed to have gained or lost a residence while confined in any public prison. However, when it comes to redistricting in Oregon, we count prisoners in the district in which they are housed, not in which they are a resident. Right. Furthermore, after their prison terms, we statutorily mandate that they as part of their parole or post-release supervision conditions, that we dictate that they must return, quote, and reside in the county where the person resided at the time of the offense that resulted in the imprisonment. In other words, everyone must return to their home county. So I would argue that people should be counted in their area of residence. Treating incarcerated people as residents of a correctional facility ignores the state constitution, in my opinion, and gives people living near prisons undue influence. So, for example, in my district where I have 5 or 6 inmates, those who live near the prison in some respects are getting super representation because there's this added group of bodies that are counted for proportionment. This concept was first brought to me several sessions ago by the Prison Policy Institute, and I urge you to look at their written testimony today, as well as the written testimony of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. I'm also excited to have a number of great organizations advocating in person on the bill today, and I hope you will give due consideration to this, and I vote to move us closer to a districting process that honors Oregon's Constitution and the democratic principle of one person, one vote. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Senator Shields. And Representative Bentz, would you like to go ahead?
Sure, thank you. I'm Chair Cliff Bentz, District 60. This was just brought to me a couple of days ago, and upon reflection, it appeared to me that the size of my district and the Senator Ferrioli's was so modest, in fact, we need to add another 3,000 people to it, which means we'll take over. I think Prineville will be added for us to find another 3,000 people, which is the number of folks. Actually, it's 3,600. I think there's 3,000 prisoners in Snake River and 600 up in Powder River in Baker. So that would mean, if this bill passed, that indeed the district would grow bigger. And indeed, I think that, oddly enough, even though it means we're going to have to drive even further than we currently have to, I believe that's the right thing to do. Here's why. It seems incorrect that those that we represent are understated by 3,500 people. Seems odd. It seems that the correct way to have those running for my office elected is to have the proper number of votes and folks voting for us vote. And that's how I've thought it through. As it is now, it only takes, instead of, I'm going to use pretty round numbers here, but 64,000 people in each of our districts. In my district, only 61,000 are available to vote. The other 4,000 are in prison. They're counted, but they don't vote. It seems odd. I guess it means that the senator and I get to run with a smaller group electing us than the rest of you. Seems odd. I think the proper way to do it is to have everybody left where they are, or at least perceived to be where they are, even though incarcerated, still can't vote. So the now grouping would be dispersed back the way I think it should be. And I have to say, I have not given this a huge amount of thought. When the issue was brought to me, I kind of worked my way through it and reached the point I've just stated. And the downside for the senator and I will be a much larger district, because finding 3,000 people out there is pretty tough, just saying. But so be it. I think the proper representation is probably the better way to analyze it. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Benz. Any questions? Senator Shields, do you know how many other states do it this way?
Madam Chair, I've been around the block enough to punt that to the people who have been studying this much longer
okay.
than I have.
Good answer. Okay, thank you both then for your testimony, and we'll let you go. And
thank you, Madam
we'll
Chair.
Call James Offsink, Kate Titus, and Steve Carter. We have three chairs, so if the three of you would like to come forward. And good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. Whoever wants to go first, please go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum and committee. For the record, my name is James Offsink, and today I'm representing the City Club of Portland and the Redistricting Matters Coalition. This was excellent testimony that Senator Shields and Representative Benz provided. So it's a hard act to follow. But this bill is really important and represents a best practice that is seen academically and in a growing number of states across the country. There are four currently who already have bills like this enacted. And there are a number of other states who have it in the works, who have already passed through one chamber in the current session and, you know, numerous times previously. So the City Club of Portland and the Redistricting Matters Coalition support this primarily on two grounds, and the first of which I think you've heard, which is the idea of one person, one vote. And we think that's a fundamental concept in redistricting, and I think that the senator and representative have touched on that somewhat, and I think my colleagues are going to discuss it more. So the other aspect that I think is really important that is sometimes understated is that this concept really reflects that we have and believe strongly in a geographic form of democracy. So it doesn't make sense to have people who live in one area counted for the purposes of redistricting in another area. We believe that that our democracy reflects the character and qualities of communities across the state. Senator Shields and Representative Benz represent a different kind of Oregonian. And although Oregonians from all corners share a sense of wonder and appreciation for our state, it's pretty clear that opinions differ on the best way to move forward for Oregon. So there's a common thread running through community members who live together, raise their children together, and come together to solve problems. And this is why we elect representatives from geographic districts to reflect and respect that principle. So when members of one community are counted arbitrarily in another community due to a temporary incarceration, it erodes the sense of geographic representation so fundamental to our democracy. We believe that Senate Bill 331 reflects best practice nationally and would restore equity to the representation of communities across the state. We thank Senator Shields for his leadership and the Rules Committee for considering this important issue, and hope that you will agree that now is the time, as Senator Shields emphasized, to make change on this issue, as it will get harder to make any changes to redistricting as it gets closer to 2021. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum. Vice Chair Farioli and members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony. For the record, I'm Kate Titus, and I'm here representing Common Cause. And Common Cause is a 45-year-old public interest group that works to safeguard and improve the democratic process to increase public participation and faith in our institutions of self-government. I want to just touch on our connection to the redistricting issue. Common Cause has played a leadership role on redistricting both at the national level and here in Oregon. During our last redistricting cycle, Common Cause was involved in playing a nonpartisan public interest role by providing input to both the House and Senate redistricting committees, providing public education information through the media, and helping to increase participation in the public hearings that the legislature organized. After the redistricting process was over, we analyzed how it went and provided a report with our sense of what worked well and what were the areas for potential improvement in the future. And this bill that we're discussing today addresses one of the recommendations that we had for improving Oregon's redistricting process. So let me speak to why Common Cause supports Senate Bill 331. The heart of it is that it upholds the principle of one person, one vote. And I know redistricting issues are a little bit wonky, and, you know, just thinking about the if for those who lean toward math and statistics, it may be a fun exercise to think about it, but many people glaze over when we start talking about redistricting. But the basic issue here is that if you concentrate artificially a large segment of the population that actually can't vote, then you create a distortion, a skewing effect in the voting, and it makes much more sense to count prisoners who can't vote as they're naturally distributed around the state rather than to concentrate them artificially in one place so that skewing effect is more dramatic. So that's the basic issue here, and I'll speak to a couple of considerations that you might want to look at. The current distortion impacts both communities where prisons are located as well as communities with high incarceration rates, and I'll speak to both of those. Communities with prisons, they are also experiencing some distortion. It's not just between the communities where the prisons are located and the communities in other parts of the state. But within communities with prisons, you also see that distortion. I'll give Pendleton as a particularly notable example. The prison population at the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution makes up roughly 28% of a single city council district in Pendleton. So in that one city council district in Pendleton, three voters have the power of four voters in the rest of Pendleton. So you can see even within one house district, you've got this impact that's distorting. It also, of course, has an impact of diluting the vote in parts of the state or places where there's a higher rate of incarceration because you're not counting, you're diluting the vote of those communities that are losing prisoners. And I would just point out one example on this. Oregon's Native American population has an incarceration rate that's more than twice the rate of white Oregonians. Native Americans make up 1% of the total Oregon population, but 3% of the incarcerated population. And for the most part, prisoners are located outside the tribal areas, so that the voting power of non-incarcerated Native Americans is diluted. And that's why you'll see a letter of support for this bill from the Grand Ronde tribe. And though there isn't testimony here, we've talked with some of the other tribes who are also supportive. Additionally, it's worth considering that for the purpose of voting, the legal standard leans toward having people vote in their own communities, not where they are incarcerated. And two things I'll just note on that. In states where prisoners do vote, and there's two, Vermont and Maine, in these cases, people vote with absentee ballots in their home community elections, not in the elections where the prisons are located. That's thought to be the more appropriate place for them to be voting.
Also, by our own law here in Oregon, current practice of counting prisoners where they're imprisoned is inconsistent with the court decisions that exist and state laws on this that indicate a person doesn't lose their residency status during a temporary absentee. And I'll point out that the Oregon State Constitution is clear that a prison is not a residence. It says, for the purpose of voting, no person shall be deemed to have gained or lost a residence while confined to any public prison. So I think this is more what Senator Shields is proposing is actually more consistent with our current law in any case. So to summarize, I would just like to say that Common Cause recommends, for the purpose of redistricting, the appropriate place to place to count prisoners is in the communities where they're residents, not where they're incarcerated. For several reasons, it's more consistent with current law. It's less likely to skew the relative voting strength within communities where prisons are located, or between those communities and the rest of the state. Less likely to dilute voting strength of communities with high incarceration rates, and it better upholds the principle of one person, one vote. I'm appreciative of the committee for considering this bill, and I urge you to vote the bill out of committee for consideration by your colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Carter. I'm here on behalf of AARP Oregon. I'm a volunteer and member of the State Executive Council. I'm from Portland. AARP is perhaps best known as the champion of seniors, health and welfare, financial security, consumer protection. But the first chapter of our national policy talks about government integrity and civic engagement. And one of the things in that policy book talks about full and fair equal representation in voting. That's why we are here today, because we believe Senate Bill 331 addresses and corrects an inequity in representation in Oregon. In order to have equal weight of votes, we need to have this legislation passed so that votes will be counted equally in weight among members of the community. As it happens now, as has been stated, we have a distortion where locations where there's a high concentration of prisoners and perhaps a less populated area have a greater weight in the votes of the constituents there. And conversely, the people in areas where there are no prison, but oftentimes where the prisoners come from, their point of origin, have their votes diluted. So as AARP would like to see, and we do recommend passage of Senate Bill 331, and urge your support. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all for your testimony. Any questions?
Just a factoid, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Farioli.
Those that are incarcerated are returned to the community from which they were originally sentenced. It's a consideration for a host communities where facilities are located, corrections facilities, to assure those communities that inmates just won't be dumped out the door and into the community that they really have no connection with, possibly, or very little support network. So if you're looking at the custom that we use and the practice that we use, it's to keep that person connected with their community after they leave the corrections institution. So, you know, why then would it be sensible to count them in the voter registration rolls in the community where they're incarcerated? So
right.
Just sort of pointing out that there's other places where this has also been thought through decided along the lines that this bill suggests.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Farioli. Anybody else? Okay, thank you all for your comments.
Thank you.
And we have two more people signed up. I'll call them both together, Norman Terrell and Darlene Huntress, if the two of you would like to come forward. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee, and please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Norman Terrell. I'm representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And I might for the record, note that I am a former member of the National Board of the League of Women Voters and a computer software engineer, and so I understand the kind of data that's involved in here very well. And I am also a member of the study committee that's referenced in our testimony. I helped write the report for the Oregon League's study on redistricting from 2007, together with my colleague, Cappy Eden, who's sitting behind me. In that study, after that study, we had a consensus process among Oregon members. The study concluded with the redistricting position that is also attached to our testimony. Furthermore, the League has a long tradition supporting improvements in the representation of citizens and in the transparency in government. SB 331 would require that prisoners be counted for the purposes of redistricting in the communities where they are residents, rather than where they are imprisoned. This would uphold the principle of one person, one vote, and would remedy distortions in representations caused by how Oregon currently counts prison populations during redistricting. The League also believes that Senate Bill 331 would improve the representation of the prisoners themselves by the public officials and the communities where they reside, rather than those public officials where they are incarcerated. Since this proposal has been discussed since 2011, the League believes that it is an idea whose time has come. We urge you to move a bill forward on this subject during this session, far ahead of the highly political time of the next redistricting in 2021. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this legislation.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello, Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Farioli, and members of the Senate Rules. My name is Darlene Huntress. I live in Salem, Oregon, and I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Action. If you're not familiar with us, we're a statewide multiracial and multiethnic community organization that's dedicated to social justice. We assist people to organize on their own behalf with a focus on low-income people, people of color, and others with limited access to traditional structures of power and policymaking. We have an office in Portland, an office in Rogue Valley. We have about 10,000 members, many of whom identify as either people of color, new immigrants, or low-income folks. And the good news is, or perhaps the bad news is, I have absolutely nothing revolutionary to share with you that has not already been talked about by folks who have been up here before, but we felt compelled to be here today to support SB 331. And I would just like to highlight one thing that really brings me here today to represent the members of Oregon Action. It's to highlight something that Kate from Common Cause mentioned earlier. There are unintended consequences and political distortions that happen when you relocate a large number of urban minority prisoners to a mostly white rural area and then count them as constituents there. The result is a shift in power between the residents of prison districts and those residents who don't have non-voting prisoners swelling their numbers. And that shift generally is at the expense of a very specific group of urban communities where most prisoners originate. That would be African American, Latino, or low-income community members. Our point is that these are communities who are often disenfranchised to begin with, and who have large challenges and barriers in the democratic process. And so diluting their voting strengths only adds to the list of those barriers. We believe that it further marginalizes them from decision-making, and particularly those voices that are so important. And we believe that SB 331 would address these unintended consequences by requiring the collection of home addresses of incarcerated people and correcting the census population data to reflect people in their homes at their home address for state, county, and municipal redistricting purposes. That is what I have to say. I really appreciate you taking the time to hear our testimony and urge you to vote this bill out of committee for consideration of your colleagues.
Okay, thank you both for your testimony. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I don't wish to appear argumentative, but I would call it a shift of powerlessness rather than a shift of power.
That's
the point that I'm making here is that a 3,000 person increase in my district because of the incarcerated members would have the impact of on my 34,000 square mile district is negligible. So I get letters from Oregon Correctional Institution and from other institutions that are located in or around my district, Powder River. And I try to be responsive to those without knowing, you know, where the constituent was incarcerated from. But if we find information in the correspondence that indicates a point of origin, a residency, we'll also involve the home district representative or senator. And so I could argue that it's possible that some of those inmates get better representation because they get more people responding to their letters.
I would just like to say I appreciate that, and one of the things that I like about passing bills and statutes is that we don't have to depend on the kindness of folks like you to do that. I do appreciate that, and
Manager, just one last point of clarity.
Yes, follow up.
Most of these folks are not voting because they've lost their voting privileges. So the idea that there would be a difference in the outcome or the turnout in elections is really not the case. It's really, it's a statistical issue. And for what it's worth, I just still think what the principle at stake here is, since folks come from a community and will be returned to that community, since absence doesn't destroy residency, probably they ought to be counted from their home district.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Andrew.
Okay, thank you, Senator Ferrioli. Anyone else? Okay, I don't see any other questions, so thank you both
Thanks.
For your testimony. We'll let you go. That completes our witness list, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 331. And I think next we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 99 and Senate Bill 690. And we will call Senator Thatcher forward. And I think, did you have somebody you were bringing with you or no? Okay. And Senator Boquist, did you wish to testify as well?
I'll just make comments.
Okay.
I'm here for moral support.
Okay.
Okay, great.
She doesn't cover it all, question her to make sure we get all the points covered.
Good afternoon, Senator Thatcher. Thanks for waiting so patiently.
Thank you. I wasn't sure if we were going to be hearing 105 first or anyway.
No,
that's
we wouldn't
fine.
Do that to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, state senator from Kaiser, representing areas clear up to Hillsborough. And I'll assure you, I did not wake up one day and say, wow, we just need to change the time alignment in Oregon. But I have heard from a number of constituents, and one in particular persuaded me that I needed to introduce a bill for him. His name is Gene McIntyre. His name is on the bill. He couldn't be here today. And I will give you his testimony, but I'll take some parts out of it. One of his points he wanted to make is that he says that he finds daylight savings time to be unnecessary and annoying. And he goes on to say that in modern times, we're no longer in a mainly agricultural economy. And secondly, from a science and human health perspective, he explains that our circadian rhythm is under a siege for a lot of reasons these days due to time constraints, work schedules, and demands to produce that could often use a 30-hour day. And he says, third, other states have recognized the absurdity of this particular time alignment and are considering its logical termination. So he says that since Oregon has been a progressive state, this change would complement other ways we found to improve our lives while reducing stress and tension. And that's from Gene McIntyre. And I was trying to find some jokes on daylight savings time, and the only one I could find was one from Victor Borgia. He says, I don't mind going back to daylight savings time. He says, with inflation, the hour will be the only thing I've saved all year. So maybe we can put that in with the pension bill, too. So he says, Okay, so there are a lot of pros and cons, and I think I've told you, Madam Chair, that if I wanted to pick a time to line up with, it would be daylight savings time, because I like it to be light late at night. That's my personal preference. But there are a lot of reasons to get rid of the at least the switching back and forth, and one of them being the weeks or the days following the switch daylight savings time include an uptick in fatal traffic accidents, include an uptick in heart attacks. There are actually no studies that indicate there is a savings in energy, like has been touted over the many years. I think in 2005, they called it the Energy Savings Act of 2005, something along that line, but it has proven that that's not really the case, that we're not saving energy moving to daylight savings time. And I have been truly amazed with how many people have written into me. I don't know what response you have gotten, but a great number of people have written in saying, we should just abolish this. We don't need to have this archaic practice any longer. There are also a lot of people on the other side of the issue saying, I would miss daylight savings time. And it just comes down to a personal preference, and that's why I say we should send it to the voters. Now, I would also submit to you, Madam Chair, an idea that maybe you would prefer an amendment that we move to Mountain Standard Time all year round, that we would be Mountain Standard. We would be Standard Time and sort of Daylight Savings Time all at the same time, make everybody happy. We wouldn't be switching back and forth. And some states have done that. But the point is that there's a benefit for keeping on one standard time. And Microsoft and other companies would like some lead time, some notice as to a time change. And that's why I said that we should have I just threw out there a 5-year lead time. It doesn't have to be that. We can go for a shorter time. But since it affects everybody, I figured throwing it to the voters would be a good idea. And that's why mine is set up to be a referral to the voters and Senator Boquist has a different idea, so maybe he can talk about his.
And it looks like he's joined you. So welcome, Senator Boquist, to the other side of the dais.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Brian Boquist, Senate District 12. Very similar to Senator Thatcher. I mean, I didn't wake up one morning in the dark and decide that this is a good idea. I actually, the same thing, had a lady named Linda Lambert from my district contact me, and she approached it from purely the business perspective of changing back and forth, saving energy, and along that line. And it's interesting to look, if you don't know, it's kind of odd, that this sounds like it's in the right place, but if you don't know, daylight savings times first came up as a modern issue in 1895. And out of 1895, the reason the gentleman wanted to do it is he wanted to go out and look for butterflies and bugs in the evening. So he wanted the New Zealanders to change time zones or change the clock back so when he got done with work, he could go out and look for butterflies and bugs. It didn't take hold till World War I. And if you don't know, you could call this wartime light time or whatever you want to call it, because each and every implementation of daylight savings times in the history here, modern history, has been revolving around a wartime footing. It went into Europe and the United States during World War I because they wanted to reduce the electricity consumption, specifically coal. We all have this, low carbon fuel standards, environmental issues, and everything else around electricity. It pursued and came and went throughout the United States basically for the last 100 years. If you poll it right now, about 60% say they don't like daylight savings time because they want one time, and 28% say let's stick with daylight savings time because we like one time. The constituents have been reaching out to me have kind of approached this from a perspective of every time you switch, it costs money, and then there are the energy saving issues that are out there. There are studies everywhere, but there's actually an Indiana study, which is really the best one, and it analyzed actual electrical bills, actual consumption, and actual results. Most of the other studies that you hear toted around out there are models, kind of like the model of the low carbon fuel standard, or like the model of our revenue forecast, of which, one side or the other can agree that this modeling sometimes is not exactly accurate. the constituents have been reaching. I was surprised because I sponsored the bill because the lady wanted to bring it come forward. It had some good, interesting ideas to it. And it's actually running about 10 to 1 in favor of let's come up with one time. In other words, daylight savings time or standard time, let's not do the switchover. You hear and you can study and look about, well, there's supposed health effects for this and health effects for that. What is interesting is again, the politics of this, because as I mentioned, not only did it come out of wartime footing, even in the Vietnam War, it also was re-extended in the United States primarily when we got out of the war footing by retail sales. The notion that the more barbecues are sold if you have daylight longer. Now, this is actually how it was lobbied in the American Congress, is that we can sell more barbecues, we can sell more golf balls, and we can sell more of that by having more daylight in the evening. Now we're kind of at the point where, you know, we are getting greener. We are getting trying to get more efficient in what we're doing out there and taking a little bit stronger look at the way forward. There is savings, supposedly, and you would think, because I got up, you know, this is Monday morning, Madam Chair, you pointed out, and we just changed the clock. I got up in the dark, and so when I got up, what's the very first thing I did? I turned the light switch on, and I went to the bathroom. Normally, I don't have to do that because the light is shining across the room at this time of year, but we just kind of moved the clock backwards as it's there. Like Senator Thatcher, I don't have a particular position of the best way if one was to proceed to go forward on this, but what I do know is that like every other tool in the toolbox, I was mentioning to somebody earlier, I look over to the doorway over here, and I see the light switches. And when I was a kid, when I was growing up, it was during the Nixon administration, and we had an oil war after the 73 Israeli invasion. And we had this big move across the entire country about conservation. And they came around from the local PUD, and they gave out little plastic and paper things you put over the light switch that says, conserve energy, turn out the lights. And as much as we like to talk about it, things like that work. We need to conserve energy. And if we're going to go down the road and be the first, we just heard that there's 4 states in the previous bill in regards to voting. If we're going to join someone like Arizona, who doesn't seem to be negatively impacted and positively impacted, and if you go farther north where you think this isn't a good idea, there are multiple Canadian provinces that have a single time zone. And maybe, as was said, Representative Bentz might enjoy that they could join us in our time zone for once instead of being in a different time zone over in Ontario. But I think there are merits to looking at this, whether it goes forward or not today or in the future. But it needs to be another one of those things that we look at in terms of what's the tool in the toolbox, does it save electricity, and what's the economic benefit here in Oregon? Because things are going to probably get a little tough at the next swing and the next cycle of economics. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both for your testimony. Any questions?
I just want to add one thing.
Senator Thatcher.
You know, we think of daylight savings time as the non-standard part of standard time, but you think about it, standard time is for fewer months during the year than daylight savings time. So really, daylight savings time, we have longer during the year than standard time. So anyway, going one way or the other, I'm still hoping for more daylight than standard time. So,
and just for the record, I'm the green person here.
Okay, and go. Senator Thatcher, we have received a great deal of written testimony on both sides of the issue,
So
it definitely sparked a pretty intense debate.
Madam Chair, when it started coming out suddenly, I thought we were back to pumping your own gas again. Self-service fuel is just like this.
Yeah. Okay, thank you both. We do have one additional person signed up, and it's Matthew Beasley. So if you'd like to come forward.
Hi, I'm Matthew Beasley. I'm a resident near Dallas, Oregon. I'm one of Boquist's constituents, Senator Boquist. Thank you all for the opportunity to speak. I didn't write in. I work here in town, so I thought it would be an opportunity to come in and support the bill. I like either idea. I don't want to take a lot of time because there's a lot of points covered. But one thing I haven't heard mentioned yet is all of the different daylight saving time rules around the world. When Congress changed it, I believe it was 2006, 2007, they missed the opportunity to align with Europe. And so what we have, I frequently deal with Europe on business, and we have most of the year we're 8 hours from Europe time, except for a week we're 7 hours, and another week we're 9 hours. And when we're dealing with Europe, we'll alternate dealing with Asia, we're alternating depending on what time of the year it's. So it's always this juggle, especially if you're dealing with meetings with multiple locations. Then it just adds extra complication that all the time it's, oh, next week we got to do an hour earlier, an hour later. But otherwise, very much support of the bill. The only other thing I wanted to add is we don't want to forget Malheur County out there in eastern Oregon, that a lot of the reason they're on Mountain Time is because of the media market, and we may want to consider writing the bill that it pays attention to what Idaho is doing for their part of the time zone.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, I don't see any questions for you, so
thank you
again. Is there anyone else here who wants to testify on these bills? Okay, I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 99 and Senate Bill 690. We have one bill remaining, and so I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 105. And, Senator Thatcher, I think, has stepped out into the hall, but we'll be back shortly, and we do have somebody here to talk about it. We'll ask Aaron to explain it to us and ask Betsy Earls to come forward.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 105 creates Sunset Advisory Committee. It abolishes state agencies on specified dates and requires agencies subject to abolition to make a report to committee, requires committee to conduct performance evaluation of agencies based on specified criteria and make recommendations to governor and legislative assembly on the continuation, reorganization of agencies and other matters, clarifies that agency may not adopt rules that conflict with statute, provides that agency may not rely on general statutory grant of authority to adopt rules that conflict with more specific statutory provisions or to adopt rules that modify protections, sanctions, eligibility, or other matters governed by more specific statutory provisions, requires that agency notice of proposed rulemaking include copy of proposed rule or link to agency's website where copy of proposed rule may be found, requires audit of state agencies by Department of Administrative Services to determine if agencies have complied with statutory requirement that agencies review rules every 5 years. There is an emergency clause on the measure. We have no revenue impact, and a fiscal impact has not been issued.
Okay, thanks, Erin, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. Looks like you're on your own.
So. I'm on my own. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing before you in support of Senate Bill 105. I think at first blush, Senate Bill 105 sounds a little bit dry, but there actually are a few states that have implemented a Sunset Advisory Commission, such as Senate Bill 105 implements, and it is worth a look, and it's interesting to review the processes that other states have gone through when they have worked through Sunset Advisory Commission processes of their own. So the bill would create, as I said, a Sunset Advisory Committee, which would review state agencies, boards, and commissions on a rolling basis. The bill implements or imposes a sunset date on a set of agencies or advisory committees every 2 years. And those bills then would go through in-depth review with the Sunset Advisory Committee staff. The parameters for that review are set out in the bill. And then the staff would report back on their findings about the agency to the Joint Sunset Committee, basically about whether the agency was fulfilling certain parameters and whether it should be abolished, whether it would be better merged with another agency, or whether it was in good shape and should continue as it was. The way the bill has worked in other states, and I believe how it works here, is a bill is then drafted based on the Sunset Advisory Committee's review of it. The bill comes to the legislature, and then the legislature lifts the sunset on the agency and continues on. So I'll wrap up here, but I would like to point out to you that Minnesota and Texas and a couple of other states have effectively implemented such a Sunset Advisory Committee. And Texas in particular has had theirs in place since 1977. It's a pretty interesting process. And I excerpted some of the FAQs from the Texas Sunset Advisory Commission, and those are posted for you on OLIS. And I do urge you to look through those, because it appears that the state of Texas saves about $25 in saving state agency efficiencies for combining or abolishing agencies or streamlining processes for every dollar they spend in reviewing and auditing. We urge your consideration.
OK, Okay, thank you for your testimony, and welcome back, Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm Senator Kim Thatcher from Kaiser, and I apologize I missed the testimony, so I might be covering some of the same things. All right, well, thank you for allowing a public hearing on this. I know that this bill has been heard in the past. In fact, Senator Jackie Winters has had a bill that had this exact same language in it. It contains much of the same language. I added a few things. And I believe Senator Starr has also had a similar bill, and I loved it, so I decided to also bring my own. Multiple benefits for Oregon. It would reduce, hopefully, reduce the size and cost of government. Reduce, we talk a lot about reducing regulation, and we talk about, as a legislature, we want to increase economic growth. At least that's what many of us talk about. And we want to eliminate redundancy and waste and want our government to be more efficient, effective, and accountable. So, without going into the deep details of the bill, I'll walk through some of the highlights. It establishes, of course, the Sunset Advisory Committee, and it would be a standing legislative committee, similar in how the Joint Tax Credit Committee was set up. It would use the timeline outlined in the bill, sort of like how the Tax Credit Committee had a sort of schedule to review. In this case, it would review a list of agencies, boards, and commissions, and it would have deadlines for their review and for making recommendations to the rest of the legislative body. The committee would do a performance evaluation of each of the agencies, and they would include a number of recommendations and look at a number of criteria, including the mission, the efficiency, the type of regulations, whether there's a duplication of service, the kind of complaints about the agency from the people they regulate, if there's a better way to carry out the mission of the agency, you know, all kinds of things. There are about 12 different criteria that they would look at. And then the committee would make recommendations on whether to continue the committee, consolidate it, maybe recombine it, or sunset that particular government agency, reorganize it, just whatever. Then also the committee would be a gatekeeper to look at any new agencies proposed by the legislature. Finally, since this was kind of a good government oversight bill, I wanted to add in a few minor things about administrative rules. It would make sure that administrative rules can't, so it would reiterate that administrative rules can't overstep state law. And there would be a section that requires state agencies to post the proposed rule changes on their websites and let people know they can read them on the web when they send out their rulemaking notices. The Secretary of State has an administrative rule website, but appears to only post rules after they've been adopted. And then thirdly, to follow up on a bill that I managed to get passed in my first session back in 2005, which includes a new law, or back then it was new anyway, but it would require agencies to do a five-year look back after they adopt agency administrative rules to make sure that the rules were doing what they were intended to do. And in 2012, I learned the hard way that just because you pass a law doesn't mean necessarily that agencies will follow it. And so some agencies may not have always been fulfilling this obligation. So this bill would just ask the Attorney General to send out a general reminder to the agencies about the responsibilities to review their rules. And it would ask the Department of Administrative Services to use their current internal auditing functions to check and make sure the agencies are following the law. And then Betsy talked about the Texas Sunset Advisory Commission, which is a good example. And there are a number of other states that have sunset advisory committees and or some other form of robust review of state agencies. So anyway, with that, thank you for your consideration.
Okay, thank you, Senator Thatcher. Do we have any questions? Okay. Well, we will take this under advisement. Thank you both for your testimony, and we'll let you go. And I think, and I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 105, and I believe that completes our agenda for today. So members, thank you very much for your time and your attention, and with nothing further to come before us today, we're adjourned.